Lend Me Your Ears, the Oral Dramaturgies Podcast. The Gallery, interviews with artists.
Hello and welcome to The Gallery. Our guest today hardly needs any introduction. Her works are as famous in Europe as they are in her native Argentina, and their significance reaches far beyond the confines of theatre itself. After an initial period of experimenting with playwriting, music making, and ensemble theatre, Lola Arias has since 2007 been committed to documentary theatre. She has made biographical work with non-professional theatre artists about living under dictatorship in Argentina, about depression, and about being a twin, and has created a work inspired by Brecht's three-penny opera in Bremen in 2015 with the city's real-life beggars, prostitutes, and street musicians. In 2016, she premiered two important works, Minefield, made at the Royal Court Theatre in London with the veterans of the Falklands-Malvinas War from both sides, and The Atlas of Communism at the Maxim Gorky Theatre in Berlin, made with women aged 8 to 84 with links to GDR. In 2018, she made What They Want to Hear, a work with and about a migrant from Syria in Munich. And in 2019, she made Futureland in Berlin with and about the unaccompanied minors fleeing war and poverty. She has also launched her film career, which includes multi-award-winning Theatre of War from 2018, based on the same material as Minefield. Since 2012, she has curated programs of performance lectures in various places, including a Zoom edition during the COVID-19 lockdown. This conversation, focusing on Lola Arias's work with speech, sound, and documentary materials, took place on Zoom on the 4th of June, 2020.
So Lola, you have such an amazingly rich practice. It's really almost difficult to decide where to start from in telling this story. And also, I've just been looking at this wonderful book that Jean Graham Jones has edited and co-written about your work. And have also read the interview that you've given to Richard Goff. So I don't want to ask you to repeat the various things you've already said to other people. But I'm interested in how we might sort of piece together a slightly different story around your way of working, which is present in this existing rendition. But I just want to go a bit more deeply into understanding how you've developed this artistic idiom that you use in your work that is characterized by the use of speech in how you help other people tell their stories, how you also tell your own stories through your work, and also how you use music as a really integral part of this. I mean, when we look through this book edited by Jean, there are a lot of images in it that are people playing instruments. You know, there is a lot of rock iconography in it. I'm quite interested in how this has emerged. And I know that not all of your work does that. But it is interesting that actually there is something distinctive about your aesthetic that kind of exists in this space around music and verbal delivery. Normally with these conversations, I ask people to go back to the beginning. And we kind of try and retrace the steps of how we arrived where we are now. But also, I've just been looking at the works you've sent me that you've made more recently in Germany, specifically Futureland, which you made at the Gorky last year, and which you made with unaccompanied minors, the refugees coming from various places, politically difficult places. And also What They Want to Hear, the piece you made in Munich in 2018, again with a refugee corps and open border ensemble. Also, I've seen Atlas of Communism. That's also very interesting to me personally as someone who has lived through a communist past. What struck me in watching these works in preparation for this conversation is how your work is often about you sort of helping other people tell the story of their lives in different ways. And maybe we can just begin this time with these more recent works and then go back. How has this come about, this work you're doing in Germany with displaced people and placing their stories and the telling of their stories with Raed Alcor particularly? The subject seems to be the actual ways in which he tells his story, and that story is mediated through a number of different interpreters, administrative workers, and so on, and then in the form of theater itself.
The topic of migration and how do we tell the story of people who are coming from wars, from hunger, from all kind of political persecution. It's something that I'm very interested in terms of what are the narrations that are being around this immense amount of people that are arriving and dying in the sea and trying to find a way to have a future. And in these particular two last pieces that I did in 2018 and 2019, for me it was very important to make the focus on the way we are interpreting and translating and decodifying and assimilating these stories. The title of the piece is What They Want to Hear. So it's really about like the story someone tells and the story the other hears. And because specifically in the asylum cases, it's so difficult to prove someone's story, that's the main thing. So how do we give asylum to someone when this person has only his story or her story to tell? There are no proofs. And regarding the law, you can get asylum if you are being persecuted because of political reasons, because of your sexuality, or because of religion. And to be able to prove these reasons, you need certain things that people don't have anything. They just have their stories. The art of storytelling becomes so relevant because your life depends on your capacity of telling your own story in the way it fits for the bureaucratic purposes of getting asylum. So basically, if you are a good storyteller, maybe you get asylum, and if you're not, then you're lost. So basically, it's all based on the art of storytelling. For specifically this piece, What They Want to Hear, we work with the transcription of the interviews. So how this person's story has been interpreted by a translator first, and then transformed into a text by a bureaucrat, the Entscheider in the German system, which means the decider. And in all this process, from he telling the story to the translator translating the story to the bureaucrat writing the story, what is left of the story is really different from what it was told in the beginning. So for me, it was very interesting to make Raed come on stage to reconstruct word by word the transcriptions of his interviews that were used to deny him asylum, because he was denied asylum. He was told he has to go back to Syria when he was coming from Dera, which was one of the worst. The whole revolution started in Dera. He was an archaeologist working in the university. There was a lot of reasons to give this person asylum, because he was politically active, because he was part of the revolution, because he was also running away from the military army, because he was supposed to enter the army when he finished the university, and he didn't want to kill or let himself die. So there were a lot of reasons to give him asylum, and he was denied the asylum. And in the case of Futureland, I was working with a group of unaccompanied minors. They were coming from different parts of the world. Some come from Syria, there were Afghanis, there was also a girl from Guinea, there was another young girl from Bangladesh. So it was a very mixed group. And basically the only thing that they had in common was that they crossed the world by themselves, 11, 12, 13, 14 years old. looking for a future. And in this case, I was, of course, interested in the process of what is called in Germany integration, like the different steps that they have to go through to be accepted. Because the difference with unaccompanied minors to adults is that they cannot be deported. So they have to be integrated. They have to be allowed to study and learn the language and get a home and be taken care of until they are 18. But of course, afterwards, nothing is for certain. So in a way, I was interested in how do you grow up going through all these constant auditions without knowing what is your future looking like, because you don't know if you will be able to stay at the end of this long journey or not. So how do you grow up with this fear of becoming 18 when every other kid is looking forward to be 18 and be independent and free? These kids grow up with the fear of growing up, basically.
Yes, and you also made an interesting aesthetic choice in terms of the world that you've created for these kids in Futureland, specifically of how they're actually interacting with these disembodied voices of AI generated characters that stand for both some sort of a sci-fi utopian idea of future, but also these authority figures that they are contending with through this.
Yeah, this was really a discovery from working with them. And during the workshops, I discovered that all the kids were playing this game called PUBG, which is a game of surviving. And in this game, there is a person arriving in a plane and lands in an island. And this person has to survive in this island, basically has to avoid being killed and kill to be able to survive. And I thought, wow, these kids do have survived these crazy journeys that lasted months, sometimes years, crossing borders, crossing situations with a lot of violence, police, going into boats in the Mediterranean, like, and now they arrive to Germany and they are playing this game of surviving in an island. And I thought, wow, the survivor is playing the surviving game. And then I thought, maybe that's the way to represent how they feel now in Germany. The journey, it's over, but in a way they feel like they landed in this island and they have to still survive these permanent proofs. And they know that not all of them will be able to stay. So basically, they have to be the strongest one. And then we started to develop together with two video artists, Mikko Gestel and Luis Crowen, this whole idea of avatars playing the roles of the bureaucrats and the social workers and their tutors, and somehow to represent this whole world of adults and authorities through avatars. And I think that was very challenging because of course you have to consider that in this piece I have like 8 performers who are humans and there is a lot of other performers who are avatars, but they are still, they have to play their role and they have to be in time, and if the machine and the person don't get together, it doesn't work. So it was also quite a challenge.
My name is Radel Kour. I am a Syrian archaeologist. In 2013, I escaped from the war in Syria. 2014, I arrived to Germany and started the process of asylum. 4 years later, I was invited to reconstruct my story with Syrian and German actors.
Come. Yeah.
Danke. Name.
Your name?
Ra'ad.
Familia name?
Your last name?
Al-Kur.
Al-Kur. Geburtstag?
Date of birth?
9th of March, 1988.
How did you meet Ra'ad? How did you become aware of his story in the first place? Was it that it started with the fact that you wanted to do his story, or was he already a member of your ensemble and then you discovered his story?
I was invited to work with the Open Border Ensemble, which was a group that was working at the Kammerspiele. It was a group of actors coming from Syria that were invited to be part of the ensemble in the State Theater of Munich. So basically, I was invited to work with this group of Syrian actors and German actors together. So I started to think what was the story I want to tell with these actors, because I wanted to tell one asylum story. I started to look for a person. So I interview, in fact, many, many refugees from different ages and backgrounds. And I heard like the most horrifying stories that I heard in my life. I felt myself like an outsider in a way, like just sitting there and hearing all these crazy stories of people escaping war, violence, hunger and all. And I was specifically looking for someone who had also the capacity to reflect on this, what it means to tell a story, and who could stand there and be able to defend his or her story, considering that it was going to be also very challenging for this person to be on stage, especially if the case was not solved, or if the case, as in Ra'ad's case, got a negative answer. And so he was the only one who really had this situation, and the rest were like professional actors, but some from Syria who already had the same background and who also had similar stories. But it was also very difficult to decide like with whom to work and what it means for this person. And I felt Ra'ad was prepared for this situation, even if we didn't manage to get him asylum, because the theater cannot change the law. But it changed a lot of things in his life. So I felt that it also made an impact. Not that we made the impact, but he himself, like committing into this piece and telling his story and getting in contact with theater and documentary theater, he changed his whole life, because now he's like studying for documentary filmmaking in a very prestigious school in Munich, where only few people managed to get accepted. And he got a scholarship because someone saw the piece and said, I want to support you. And even if his legal situation is not solved, he found a new way, a new horizon for him.
God, that's so moving, actually. So there is still no ending to his story. Like that piece ends with this statement, there is no end to this story, and still not resolved.
Yeah, and this is also crazy, because he had been for 6 years now in Germany without asylum. He's making like a career in documentary filmmaking, and he's still not a legal recognized citizen. of Germany, and there are so many people in these conditions also, like all over the world, people with no status, people that are citizens of nowhere. And this is something that it's insane.
And the kids in Berlin, the unaccompanied minors, were they already part of some sort of a group that was using theater as a way of coping, or did you actually facilitate that contact with theater for them?
I think only one of them had made theater at school, but all the rest, they discovered theater with us through the workshops. And in fact, it was quite difficult to get the young kids and teenagers to to come to the theater. In fact, I was going to institutions who work with the young unaccompanied minors. I was talking to social workers and I was going everywhere saying, look, we want to do a project about unaccompanied minors and we want to make a theater piece. But it wasn't easy to convince them to come. In fact, it was not that they were all like looking for the new theater production that is for the next season of Gorky Theater. They were more like struggling with many other bigger problems. So in fact, the theater group is still much more than a theater group in terms of, besides doing art, there is a lot of people involved in like taking care of them and giving them support. So there is a psychologist from an institution called Senion that works with unaccompanied minors. There is also the group of artists like Viviana Mendes and Laura Jimenez who are keeping regular contact with them and helping them with their homework to finding an apartment for their families when they manage to bring their families and so on. Basically, it's a big commitment to decide to work with people who are in these specific situations.
Mm. And was this your sort of impetus that you wanted to make a piece about unaccompanied minors? And what was the invitation from the Gorky? Because you had worked with the Gorky Theatre before making Atlas of Communism in 2016. Was this your second or maybe you've had other collaborations?
Yeah, I had another production called Audition for Demonstration. So it was the third collaboration with the theater. And the institution that invites me know that it's difficult to tell me I have this Hamlet or you have to work with this ensemble or we want to make a piece about these certain topics because the way I work, first of all, I don't usually work with actors. So I usually make a whole research on something and when I'm doing a research of something, that means 1 year of work. So it has to be something that I'm somehow very passionate about. Otherwise, it doesn't work. I can't do like other theater directors do that they do, I don't know, 3 pieces a year. And in fact, they told me we want to make a production with you. And then I propose them to work with the unaccompanied minors.
Great.
And they supported it. And that's mm-hmm. already a lot because that when the theater commits to something like this, that means that they have to work also in an unusual way.
Thank you for introducing this aspect of your work that is really about an alternative to the conventional institutional theater approach, which is something I'm quite interested in as part of this interview too, and in relation to your journey, your developmental journey as an artist. As I said, usually these conversations, I try and understand by revisiting the early beginnings, how people have then started to discover a way of making theater that's not about taking a text and doing it in a conventional kind of way. What's interesting about your early beginnings that you've already explained in other interviews you've given is there are, I would say, several formative influences that have somehow influenced your journey, and that's your study of literature, your work with Ricardo Bartis, who was an underground theater maker in Argentina, and whose theater group you attended, and also your kind of interest that maybe emerged slightly later in music making, working in a way that's almost like working in a band with your creative collaborators. So if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to go back there again to kind of just piece this together. Was Argentinian theater also primarily this sort of like text-based, doing plays, like the conventional kind of city theater format? Was that a dominant way, or was there another set of traditions that formed the mainstream of Argentinian theater into which you grew up?
Yeah, I think I grew up, I'm part of a generation that grew up already knowing that the state theater was not open for us. So we were not like studying like theater, acting or playwriting, thinking of when are we going to be called by the state theater to make this text or this piece. And we were more like growing up thinking that state theater was already there and that the only way to do theater was to invent our own ways of doing it. I mean, we were all very independent in a deep way. Like, we did our own projects, we produced them, we staged them, we found the place to do it, we built the scenographies ourselves, we did everything ourselves. Because there was no state support for that, and there was no money for that. So we had to find a way to do it in another way. And there is a big also tradition, if you can call it this, of actors who are also playwrights and directors. So I was not the only one writing and directing and performing. We were a bunch of people doing that. So basically, I remember the first piece I did, it was called The Squalid Family. We did it in the cultural center of the university, Cultural Center Rojas. And because we had no money for the set design, I took some things from my parents' house and some old clothes from my mother. And I remember my mother came to the opening and my father said, like, what the hell have you done with our stuff from home? So we were doing things with whatever we had, no budget, no support.
Just to put this on a timeline, this was presumably something like the mid to late
2001. I was 24. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. 2001. So did you know at that time that you were going to have a career in theater?
I don't know. I was very much interested in writing, and then making theater came a bit later. I always knew I wanted to write, and then started to be interested in in theater and performing, and music was also very important for me. I studied music since I was little, so in a way, when I started doing theater, for me it was also clear that theater was a mixture of forms. It wasn't about the text and the actors, but it was about the whole visuals of it and the sound of it and the music. And I always worked with live music. And I collaborated with musicians and not just telling them, I want this kind of music here, but we really, sometimes we compose together, we think about the ideas together, we develop the lyrics of the songs together. So it was a pretty much collaborative process.
Yeah, in fact, in your workography, if I can call it that, there is also an album that you...
There are two albums.
Two albums, yes. And I'm just trying to remember the dates of when they came out.
It's 2007 and 2011. One is called Love is a Sniper and the other one, The Ones Who Doesn't Sleep.
So that much quoted statement about you saying on some occasion that if you hadn't had a career in theater, you would have had a career as a pop star did come true in some ways. So what were the musical influences that were formative for you growing up in Argentina? Was there a local Argentinian rock and pop scene, or was it more of a kind of American and international scene that we all kind of...
No, there is a lot of popular music in Argentina, like, I don't know, from Charlie Garcia to Los Redonditos de Ricota to, I mean, there are so many bands, and Viudas e Hijas del Rock and Roll, and bands that were like Andrés Calamaro or Luis Alberto Spinetta. But I think I was always very much influenced also by the people I work with. For example, I worked several years and I still work sometimes now. We are living very far from each other with Ulises Conti, who is a musician from Argentina. And I did these two albums together with him, and he did the music for most of my projects in Argentina. He did, for example, the training and the composing of the music of Minefield together with the veterans. So these also were the people that influenced me the most, the people that I work together with.
Yes, that was a kind of like an ensemble you had at one point called the Post-Nuclear Ensemble, where Ulises Conti and a number of other people were members of this. You selected a number of artists from different disciplines relevant to theater making and worked with them, which is an interesting
model. Was that a moment at which your initial impulse to work as a playwright might have started to transform in some way, that maybe you were kind of seeing your role as a theater maker and author as a more collaborative thing?
Yeah, I think I always saw it as a collaborative thing, even when I wrote a text before and I wanted to put it on stage. I always understood theater as a collaborative thing, as something that you do together with other artists. And even now, if somebody works with me, they know that I can be very demanding, very chaotic, but also very open, so that everybody has a voice in the rehearsal room, meaning like that every decision, and it doesn't matter like if it's about the music or about the set or about the scene, everybody has the possibility to say, I don't like this text, or I don't like this scene, even if it's the musician having an opinion on the set or the set designer talking about the songs. And I don't see like these divided territories and then people only working on their field. I like teams that work together and think about a complete work of art. That's why people feel very encouraged to talk and to be part of the discussion and not just to take care of one thing. But it can also be very demanding for people that are used to do their thing and then go out. I don't let them go out. I lock them in the room and now you will stay with us until we solve this.
I'm sorry, I don't know how you will feel about this question, but what was it like for you being a woman and carving out a way for yourself in Argentinian and later international theater? I'm asking also because in looking at all of these key influences that have been cited in relation to your work, like Ricardo Bartisan, Pompeia, Audivert, and so on, it's usually men, right? It's usually men we hear about. And also these musicians you've just mentioned. How was it for you finding a voice as a female artist in that environment?
Yeah, one thing I want to say is that I also work a lot with women and mm-hmm. and my main like collaborators in Argentina, Luz Algranti and Sofia Medici, who are dramaturgs and producers of my work, are very, very important. And there is a bunch of female artists that I work together with, like Mariana Tirante, who is a set designer of many of my works, Luciana Cunha, who was choreographer of many of my works. So there is not, I'm not surrounded by men, so to say. But of course, like being a female director wasn't easy, I think, especially when I was younger. I used to get really mad and really angry and really sad when I felt I was not recognized just because I was a woman. It was also this transition from being a local artist in Argentina and like making my own works with the post-nuclear company, and like I did several works starting in 2001 and then until 2007. And 2007 I did a trilogy of three pieces that were under this label, Love is a Sniper. And it was a trilogy that was the first piece that I started to travel with. And from then on, from 2007, I started to have like a career abroad. And also to collaborate with my former husband, Stefan Kegi, in several projects. And I think that was the worst moment in terms of recognition as a woman, was when I was working together with my partner. Because then people would think you're just the wife of...
Because Stefan Kegi had the fame of his own as a Rimini Protocol.
And of course, people didn't know me because I was coming from Argentina. And so basically, I was sitting in theaters all over the world, and I was facing once and again the situation of, like, I don't know, technical directors, directors of festivals, producers, whoever, talking to Stefan, and I was just the person standing next to him. So I think, in fact, we didn't collaborate that much because for me it was very hard. I mean, even if the artistic collaboration was great, I think it was hard to, for me, we did like, I don't know how many projects, but we did like 3 years we collaborated. And then even if we continued together a couple of years more, we were like, we said, no, we have to, like, I have to do my own work. Otherwise, I will die under your arm. You know what I mean? It's like, it's the worst. It's the worst you can do as a woman, to work together with your husband or partner or whatever. Like, because then people won't see you anymore.
And how did your work change as a result of that collaboration, if at all? And how did you manage to reclaim your own place in the sort of theater making world after those collaborations?
I met Stefan in the moment where I was also starting to do a work that was less text-based and more performative. So I met him already in a moment where I did this trilogy where there was a baby on stage and there was a whole, like, another piece which was based on the biographies of the actors and on certain documents. So I was already in this way, and we met, and then I started to also see how a documentary approach could be like, also getting to know his method of working and researching and so on. And that was very interesting for me, and I learned a lot from it. And then, of course, there was a time when I also had to adapt and say, okay, this is how you work, but I also need another conditions. I need other things, and I'm more interested in this and that. But I always felt a writer, which is also something that not a lot of people recognize in my work, that I feel like I'm basically the writer of all the pieces I did, even if some of them were written in a desk outside of the rehearsal room and were fictions, and some of them were written based on interviews and improvisations with the performers in the rehearsal room. So, and this was always for me very important, the quality of the text, the images, the impact of words.
So what is the relationship between the documentary material and the sort of artistic framework of that theater makes available? I'm asking this because of the trend of documentary theater that we witnessed here in the UK in the early 2000s, which was very much concerned with being extremely faithful to the stories of real life people that it was telling, almost to the extent that it was really just trying to put those testimonies on stage in front of audiences as some form of mediated journalism. And, you know, very often these works were very powerful and very well received as works of theater. But it seems to me that in your work, there are other layers to this process, which is about putting real life testimony on stage. It's not just on that literal level. It's kind of there are levels of artistry that are involved. So what is your approach to mediating
fact and real life material that then kind of transforms it into a work of art in theater.
Yeah, I think there is a lot of prejudice and also ignorance about what it means to work with documentary material. There is a lot of people that think that you're just doing copy paste of interviews, or you're just like, you just did a piece with testimonies, as if testimony was something that it's just like you record it and then you put it and that's it. But I think this is just ignorance. I mean, I think there is always an immense amount of work in trying to make art with documents, with stories of real people, with interviews. So basically the way I work, I do a lot of interviews with people, like personal interviews where I'm like sharing time and spending time talking to them. And then there is a lot of experiments on how to tell the story that we do on stage. So basically encouraging them to improvise through materials or stories or reenactments of situations where they are put back into a situation that they experience and they have to try to remember how it was and what they told and how it. And based on these experiments, I write text that then goes back to them and then we try it again. And then sometimes there are like huge discussions on how to tell the story and what words to use and why. And I think that's the most interesting part of it, because it is a very collaborative process. Then sometimes they also have the final word, because sometimes they say, no way, I'm not going to say this text like this, and there is no way to convince them. And then you have to find a solution. This is a lot of work. This is really a lot of work. I think some people really think that I just like meet the people and they just came to the rehearsal and spoke the text the way they say it on the last day in the opening. And I'm just putting things together and making a frame for it.
Great. So there is a process that's an interactive process that happens in the rehearsal room. How long does this rehearsal period ideally last for you?
I mean, there is a research that takes 1 year. There is some phases of workshops that could take some weeks. And usually it depends on the conditions I have, but I usually ask for 3 months if I can. Like in Futureland, we had 12 weeks. Sometimes they give me less, then I add some other instances to have more time. But yes, that's more or less how long it takes.
Having mentioned Minefield, Campo Minado, which was a piece about the Falklands veterans and with the Falklands veterans, how did that come about? Obviously, there are so many factors in that particular choice that in a way made that particular project more complex than other maybe some other projects that you've done, in the sense that there was this international aspect to it where you worked with performers, subjects, I'm not sure what you call them, because they're both sources of material and collaborators and end up being performers from two different countries, but also people who had fought each other in that war, who were on opposite sides, who might have been carrying traumas. And then also there is a process that is evident in the dramaturgy of that piece whereby music brings them together in some ways. How long did that process take and how did it come about, that particular project for you?
Yeah, I think this was the longest project that I did. It took 5 years, but it also had like several outcomings. So like first, I started in 2013 interviewing veterans for a video installation where I wanted them to reenact a memory of the war in the places where they work or places they attend regularly. And in this case, I was only interviewing Argentine veterans. And this was because I was invited to be part of an exhibition that was done in 2014 for the 100 years of the First World War. That was called After the War. And when I was invited to this exhibition, I started to think about working with veterans of the Malvinas Falklands War in Argentina. And after this exhibition that happened in 2014, I started to think about it could be interesting to bring together Argentine and British veterans to reconstruct their memories of the war. And then I started a new process of interviewing British veterans and also shooting, thinking about like making a theater play and a film. And that started in 2014, 15, and then we had the opening in 2016. And then I still worked on a lot of material that I recorded during this whole process. And I came out with a movie in 2018 that was called Theater of War, which opened at Berlinale. And so it was the whole process of from 2013 to 2018 working on the same subject. In the middle, I also did other things, but it was really intense.
When I arrived in Buenos Aires for the rehearsals, I was shocked. The Malvinas was everywhere. T-shirts, car bumper stickers, wall murals, photographs down the corridor of a children's hospital. We don't really talk much about the Falklands, the United Kingdom. And British school children do not learn about the Falklands War, which is kind of surprising because it was our last old-fashioned war where British troops fought trench to trench with bayonets, just like they did in the First World War.
Cuando vamos a dar las charlas en las escuelas, al final los chicos siempre nos hacen la misma pregunta. ¿Vos en la guerra mataste a alguien?
The fact that the peace brought together these former enemies was also a very challenging thing because I had to convince people, former military people to get involved in an artistic project in Argentina with their former enemies.
Would you vote to go to war?
It was not something easy to do.
Would you send your sons and daughters to war?
Some were curious and interested.
What would you fight for?
Some were suspicious and reluctant.
La patria! Oi, oi, oi. Would you go to war?
At the end, it was only the ones I really found interesting and courageous enough to go to the end of the world.
Have you ever been to war? To war! Have you ever killed anybody? Have you watched men die? Have you?
3 months in a very precarious venue that we had invented because we had no state theater that supported us, rehearsing 6 hours a day. So it was a crazy thing to do.
Have you ever watched your friend try to commit suicide? Have you held a dying man in your arms?
They are still touring with the piece and they love the piece.
Have you? Have you? Have you? Have you ever seen a man on fire? Have you watched the guy drown in an ICC? And have you ever visited a dead friend's grave with his mother? Have you? Have you ever been to war?
And the music element of it, you mentioned earlier that your collaborator from post-nuclear ensemble, Ulysses Conti, was a significant part of this process. How did you work with the musical element on this piece?
From the beginning, I knew I wanted to make a band with former soldiers of both countries. So basically, I chose some people thinking that they were already musicians, like Ruben, for example. He's a drummer and he has a Beatles tribute band. And there were some British who already were musicians, like David Jackson, who had also a band in Cornwall. So I was already thinking that I wanted to make this band. So I chose some which were musicians, and the other ones had to learn. I mean, Gabriel also played the guitar. Marcelo had to learn how to play the bass, and Lou was mainly singing. And Sukrim, because he's from another culture, he's from Nepal, yes, and he wasn't related to this rock music at all. So he had another moments of singing, but his own songs, which were beautiful. So for me, this musical part was very important, also considering the fact that they didn't speak the language of the other. So we were always the mediators, the translators in between them. So I think it was very important that they have something to do with each other that is not language-based.
You just mentioned that you were developing this piece in Argentina outside of the structures of funded theater. Did it ever get recognized by the Argentinian theater scene?
Yes. I mean, of course, but it's also, it took a long time. Like, I think last year, 2019, we made the third season in Buenos Aires, and they gave us the biggest venue in the State Theater of Buenos Aires, which has 800 seats. And the piece was sold out for 1 month and a half. So it was amazing. But it took a long time until they recognized, oh, there is this thing. We should have it in our repertory because it's good. But I was like knocking doors when I had the project in a folder and nobody was opening the doors. So
did your parents get to see what you did in the end?
Yeah, I think they were happy there was no more furniture then, no more clothes being stolen, and that somehow it got more professional.
Yes, great. And about My Documents series that you're currently curating as part of the COVID lockdown, but which has had this precedent that you'd done in 2012 to 2017 in Buenos Aires. What's the significance of this sort of work with other artists for you? It's a curation process. You curate it. But it's obviously a different kind of output, lecture performance. What's the significance of this sort of work for you?
First of all, I think it's not easy to understand what it means curating in this case. And I think it's very different also depending on the artist, because I usually like invite an artist to develop a lecture performance on a personal archive. And then they bring ideas, and then we discuss about the ideas, and then we come together to the conclusion of which idea is the best idea to develop. And depending on the artist, I am very involved or not so involved. So this depends on the artist itself. So for example, the last lecture performance was with Zhang Menji, a Chinese amazing artist who is a dancer and a documentary filmmaker. And she had an incredible archive of work that she's doing in a small village in China. She had been interviewing elderly people on their memories of the famine. And she also had been doing an amazing work with the children of this village. And we had to get together, me and Viviana Mendez, the dramaturg, to go through all this material and think about what makes sense and why and how to put it together. So it was a very collaborative thing. While with other artists like Javier Murray, it was an already existing work that he adapted to the format of My Documents. That was very exceptional. I never did it before. So it depends on each of the artists, how much Do they want to collaborate?
And what was the impulse originally when you did it in Buenos Aires? What made you want to give this sort of a platform to other artists?
For me, it was interesting to think about the performativity of an archive. Like, how can we perform an archive? How can we bring an archive into a stage, whatever this archive might be? So this was for me one of the main interests, and also the possibility to collaborate with artists from different disciplines. That was for me very interesting, and to see how can I support them. So more than putting myself as a director of a project, it's more like being the person that facilitates the work of others, and also to learn from others, because I think it has been an amazing experience to work with so many different artists coming from so many different fields, and to try to understand how do they work and how do they develop their ideas. And yeah, it has been very, very inspiring for me, and it still is now with the COVID.
Great. And what next for you, Lola? I mean, what do you have in the pipeline when the theaters reopen, hopefully?
I'm preparing a project about motherhood, and it's called Lingua Madre. And I'm doing it in Italy, in Bologna. And it's supposed to go back to rehearsals in September. But it's a project about, reproductive rights, autonomy of mothers or women or people who want to procreate. What are all the tensions between, like, the way you want to procreate or to give life to others, and the law and the state regulations and the control of the politics regarding our own bodies and our own desire. So it's a bit about these tensions, and also about the new fertility techniques that are changing the whole, like, panorama and all the questions that are around in vitro treatments, surrogacy, adoption, and so on. Basically, we reflect on these topics with them. Now we are going to finally meet, I hope, in September.
Great. Thank you so much. This has been really, really insightful.
Thank you. I hope you enjoyed it.
You've been listening to Lend Me Your Ears, presented by Duška Radosavljević, curated by Flora Petrolo, and produced by Tim Bano. The Lend Me Your Ears podcast is part of Oral Dramaturgies, an AHRC leadership fellowship held by Duška Radosavljević at the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama.